Welcome to this RF Industry Icons podcast, our new monthly series. I'm Pat Hindel, and today I am talking with Professor Ted Rappaport, David Lee, Ernst Weber Professor of Electrical Engineering, founding director of NYU Wireless, Professor of Computer Science at NYU Current, and Professor of Radiology, NYU School of Medicine. Welcome, Ted.
Hi, Pat. Good to be with you. Thank you.
So Ted is a pioneer in radio wave propagation for cellular and personal communications, wireless communication system design, and broadband wireless communication circuits and systems at millimeter wave frequencies. His research has influenced many international wireless standards bodies, and he and his students invented the technology of site-specific RF channel modeling and design for wireless network deployment, a technology that is now used routinely throughout the wireless communications world. And recently, you were inducted into the Wireless Hall of Fame, so congratulations on that.
Thank you very much, Pat.
So let's start off with, how did you get interested in wireless technology in the first place?
Pat, it's an amazing story, and one I know I'm so blessed to have experienced. When I was 5 years old, I went to my grandpa's house in Brooklyn, New York, Grandpa Carl. He had this big, giant tube radio, like a 1920-something Philco, painted an ugly green color, and it was giant. You know, radio was like furniture, and it was mounted on the wall. My little sister slept under it. She was always afraid it would fall on her, but I would get up on her bed and tune the knobs. I was a little kid. I was five, and I'd listen to Ship to Shore, Morse code, single sideband coming in on the AM. I didn't know what single sideband was at age five, but I was just fascinated with this radio, and I'd play around whenever we'd go back to Brooklyn a couple times a year growing up. And then when I was 10 or 11, my grandpa Carl gave me an old tube type Fornair CB radio. I didn't know that you needed crystals to make CB radio sets work. So I kept trying to listen and talk on this tube CB radio, not knowing how it worked. I think I was eight when he gave it to me. Anyway, this led me to always be fascinated with radios. And when I was 13, I was playing football. I was going to be playing on the junior varsity football team, and I broke my leg in three places in a sandlot game with all the kids who were going to be on the team. Had a terrible broken leg in three places, was laid up in the hospital for 6 weeks, and then was 6 months in a body cast. And I was like dressed up like a mummy in paper mache. So all I could do was lay there for really 7.5 months and 6 months at home. Luckily, we lived close to the high school, Lincoln High School in Cambridge City, Indiana. The teachers visited me once a week, but I was laid up like a mummy and couldn't do anything but lay there. And my grandma, Grandpa Carl's wife, Nana, gave me a shortwave radio, a 10-band radio. And so laid up in a body cast, I listened to shortwave and ham radio and HCJB, DX Engineering, all these shortwave stations, collected QSL cards. And that really inspired me to love wireless. It was fascinating to me to hear the whole world coming in. I made a little cassette tape of the Morse code with my own voice and played it back to myself at night when I went to sleep. So I learned the Morse code and started learning electrical theory. And then when I was 14 years old, I got out of the body cast, walked up the hill on crutches to Doc Woodward, Mark Woodward, WB9NNO. I was this, you know, kid on crutches, and he gave me my novice amateur radio exam. And then I wound up teaching radio courses with my best friend, Tom Poland, N9NC. We were teenage kids teaching adults amateur radio, and Tom and I both went to Purdue University. So that's how I found my love of wireless, and it's never left.
Started at a young age.
Yeah, I sure did. I was very fortunate to find my passion early, and it's just a miracle to me how invisible waves travel so far. You know, you look at the stars in the sky, those stars are coming millions of years away to reach us. It's terrific.
So you mentioned that you attended Purdue University. Tell us about your educational experience.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to go to school. I graduated from high school in 1978. I was very poor. Luckily, I got an Indiana State scholarship, and I hitchhiked to Purdue. One of my friends who worked at the McDonald's in Richmond, Indiana, actually picked me up on the way to school, and he was going to Purdue too. I was there for the first week And George Cooper, a famous professor, gave a lecture to the Amateur Radio Club about the future of cellular telephone. He was talking about something called spread spectrum in 1978, and that someday cellular phones would be used as commonplace tools. It didn't exist in 1978. That was my first week at college at Purdue, and George Cooper wound up to become an important mentor and instructor for me in my graduate program. Claire McGillum was my major professor, but I loved Purdue. It was so hard, very hard. I worked three jobs freshman year, cleaning out garbage cans Friday nights in the dorm. You can imagine how fun that was. And worked really hard and put myself through Purdue. And the professors there saw something in me that I never saw in myself. And allowed me to teach the digital communications class senior year while I myself was a senior. They talked me into going to graduate school. I was just looking for a job to pay off my student loans, but they said, why don't you stay for graduate school? And I'm so thankful I did. The good Lord was watching after me because I was fortunate to be on the ground floor of the Purdue University Engineering Research Center on Intelligent Manufacturing. That's a grant that we wrote, professors and some grad students. I was lucky to be part of the team to write about the factory of the future. This is when Japan was really beating the U.S. in manufacturing competitiveness. And so our research center was really the first engineering research center in the country to bring an interdisciplinary approach in industry and academia together. President Reagan even flew out towards the end of my PhD program to visit the ERC. I got to meet him. And that really impacted my life, to be able to be part of a program that grew a center from scratch and became one of the first national centers. My thesis was on mobile robot navigation and then mobile robot communication, which led me to do the first research in the world on indoor wireless communications inside factory buildings. I measured factory buildings all over Indiana for the multipath, the signal strength, at frequencies that were not yet commercialized above 1 gigahertz. And then the founding fathers of the Wi-Fi movement, 802.4, 802.11, which was originally IEEE 802.4L, they invited me as a graduate student to present my work and later as a young professor at Virginia Tech. So I was very fortunate to be very early in on the wireless world.
Yeah, it sounds like you were always ahead of the curve there. So you started off at Virginia Tech. What did you set out to do there and who inspired you down that path?
Well, I was really attracted to Virginia Tech. I was graduating in late 1987, and I really loved the East Coast, the Mid-Atlantic region. I loved the Atlantic region of Virginia, of North Carolina, of Tennessee. So I wrote letters to several universities in Tennessee, North Carolina, and Virginia. I just loved that part of the world for some reason. And Virginia Tech was the only university that had a job opening. They had a very good satellite communications program. Well-known professors like Charles Bostian and Warren Stutzman and Tim Pratt and Fred Ritchie all were on the faculty at Virginia Tech doing cutting-edge work on satellites. So that was the closest thing to the cellular industry in 1987-88. They gave me a job offer as an assistant professor. I started as one of the SATCOM faculty members, but quickly realized my passion was really in the cellular world, what the future of Wi-Fi and cellular would be. So I started a program there, and I basically traveled around the country asking companies to pay my way. And I say, I will give you a 1 hour seminar on why you need to be investing in the cellular and Wi-Fi world. And many companies took me up on the offer. It was tough to go from Blacksburg, Virginia. You had to drive to Roanoke, then you took a puddle jumper from Roanoke to major airport, then you flew somewhere else. But I basically was hustling because the first 10 proposals I wrote as a professor were all rejected. I was writing to the National Science Foundation, the Air Force, the Navy, anywhere that I thought they would fund wireless, but no one was interested in wireless communications in 88. No one saw it yet. They were all funding satellites and fiber optics. But finally, on the 11th proposal, I got this tiny grant from a small company called LCC. Raj Singh was the CEO. He was an entrepreneur. He had written the first software used for cellular planning, ASAT. He gave me a tiny grant to travel around the country for in 2 weeks to measure the East Coast and West Coast multipath channels from actual cellular carriers with my first grad student, Scott Seidel. We took boatloads of equipment, FedExed it all around the country and measured the multipath, which wound up leading to the first U.S. digital cellular standard, both CDMA and TDMA. That was my first grant. probably no one in their right mind would have done it, but I was fortunate and I was very hungry and I had a great first graduate student. And that really made my conversion from satellite to mobile. After that, the rest was history. I had a front row seat and actually got to influence some of the early decisions in CDMA and TDMA from my wireless program at Virginia Tech. And we grew very rapidly. People were flying to Blacksburg, giving us funding, joining the MPRG, the Mobile and Portable Radio Group, before there was even cell phones working in Blacksburg. That's how desperate they needed young engineers, and there weren't many people focusing on the field, but we grew the program very rapidly.
Well, you were persistent, so it paid off. How about University of Texas and your move to NYU? How would that progression go?
Well, it was hard to leave Blacksburg because I spent 14 years there and they treated me very well. And I hired most of the colleagues in the wireless center there. And I had a wonderful house on the hill. But what happened is I was growing my second company, Wireless Valley Communications. The first company, TSR Technologies, which started in 1989, my students and I built cellular and paging intercept products that were used by law enforcement, drive testing, the early first generation and second generation of cellular. We made a great product called CellScope and PageTracker. And I was just a kid professor. I didn't even have tenure yet, growing a million-dollar plus business. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have a lot of business mentors. So I wound up selling that to Allen Telecom, and they used the core team and technology for the first E911 base station infrastructure equipment that Allen Telecom and then Andrew Corporation used. That was a very exciting ride. From that, I wrote the first textbook on wireless, which has so much real-world information in it from my startup company, TSR Technologies. But I had started a second company called Wireless Valley, and I was trying to build this company to be really a built-to-last IPO kind of business, and was trying to get venture money. And we had so many customers using our planning tools, Site Planner and Land Planner. I mean, it was really becoming an international standard and had a lot of intellectual property around it. But it was very hard to attract venture capital and leading investors to Blacksburg, Virginia. I had some great Silicon Valley investors fly to Blacksburg. You know, they flew from Silicon Valley, maybe to Charlotte to Roanoke. And then they drove an hour and they said, "Ted, I don't care what you've got here. I'm not investing. I just spent a half a day to get here." Anyway, that was a real business lesson in like 99, 2000. And then the dot-com crash hit. And they pulled all the jet airliners out of Roanoke. And that's when I realized I needed to probably leave the region to be able to build the dream of building something substantial. And so the engineers at Wireless Valley had decided on their own to go call on customers on the West Coast. We had a lot of customers in Seattle. We had Microsoft using our product. We had AT&T, which was using our product. We had Boeing. A lot of companies were using our design and measurement tools in Wireless Valley. And while they went on a sales trip to the West Coast, I got a call from the business leaders of Austin, Texas to come interview at UT Austin because the Dallas corridor had really been hurt. The telecom corridor had been hurt after the dot-com crash. They wanted to invest in wireless. And a lot of the business leaders at Freescale Semiconductor, Motorola, SBC was there. National Instruments was there. I had all their executives, top executives calling me. And while the students were on the West Coast trip, they decided to go to Austin where SBC, one of our customers for Wireless Valley was. And they loved Austin. And they had no idea while they were off making sales pitches on our product and visiting customers, I was being recruited to move to Austin. And so when they came back and said, "We want to move the company to Austin," I said, "Well, it turns out I might become a professor there." And that was very fortuitous how I got there. And Ben Streetman, bless his heart, what a wonderful dean. He saw something in me, saw what we had built at Virginia Tech, and he gave me a bigger stage to play on. He made a very nice offer and recruited me, and I got to hire a number of great star faculty who are still there. And it was a great, great team we built. The WNCG, Wireless Networking and Communications Group, started in 2002. It was a raw startup. And I had the good fortune of moving the company there. All the students the core company moved Wireless Valley to Austin, Texas. And there I really got to meet some great business mentors. Some of the key people that helped build Dell for Michael Dell became colleagues, and some of the key people who started Microsoft, they all lived in Austin. So I was really exposed to an amazing community, and we worked with the town council and the Austin Wireless Alliance. We really built some great synergy and recruited a lot of good companies to Austin, Texas. It was a great, great time.
And so then you went to NYU. How did that work out?
Well, you know, I never thought I'd leave Austin, but I always, you know, I was always an East Coast guy. The summers were so hot in Austin that I would, you know, in the first year I worked at Austin, Texas, I noticed I was the only professor in the building. It seems everyone in Austin flees to Colorado or the West Coast or the mountains. I was like the only guy working on the office in the office.
You know,
the staff
is
there, but yeah, but no professor sticks around. They go to cooler venues. So after the first year, I realized I needed to find I wanted to get a mountain house and go build a ham radio station back on the East Coast. I was born in Brooklyn, New York. I worked at Virginia Tech for 14 years. I frankly never thought I'd leave there, and always loved that part of the world. Also, I didn't like the beaches in Texas very much. I hadn't been to any, but I heard they weren't as nice as the East Coast beaches. So I, you know, was looking for property back east, and, you know, eventually built a house in Reiner, Virginia, real close to Blacksburg on top of a mountain where I was able to do my ham radio stuff about 10 years ago. So I always was getting pulled to Virginia for the summers. And what happened is, you know, I basically, there were leadership changes. The dean who hired me and the department head who hired me, they left or retired, and, you know, things started changing. And I thought, you know, maybe I should look to move to the East Coast. It's so far to get back to my mountain house in Virginia. And I was very fortunate that the two mentors who really befriended me and really served as my mentors from the very early days at Virginia Tech, Professor David Goodman and Professor Henry Bertoni, the two professors who came to my first wireless symposium that I put on in 1990 or 91, it turned out both of them worked at Brooklyn Polytechnic. And I was head of a national research center on wireless, and Brooklyn Polytechnic was one of the five or six universities in that program I headed up. And so I got to know the faculty there. And I think I went back for David Goodman's retirement party when he retired from the faculty. I went back to Brooklyn. I just really liked the faculty and colleagues there. And then out of the blue, they called me in 2011 and said, we're thinking about doing a merger with NYU. NYU was this great storied university, you know, world famous. It's in all the Hollywood movies. And NYU did not have engineering. I knew that. But what I didn't know is it used to have engineering. NYU had a great engineering program until the late 1960s when New York almost went bankrupt. And they jettisoned their engineering campus up in the Bronx. And so NYU was now trying to reestablish engineering because it had this huge investment from Abu Dhabi to build a global campus. And boy, that's an amazing campus they've built. I haven't been to it since they built the new building. But, you know, one of the key factors for having a global program in Abu Dhabi would be to have a strong engineering program. So Brooklyn Polytechnic was looking to be merged, acquired by NYU. So that was very appealing to become a faculty member to help bring street cred, to bring some acumen and, you know, how a top 10 place works. So the dean there, Srini, what a wonderful man. He flew down to Austin to see what I had built and recruited me. He said, we want to get you there. And the president of NYU and the provost and, you know, the president of Brooklyn Poly, they all recruited me and said, you come here and we'll let you get access to every roof of the building, because I asked for that. I said, I want to do 5G. No one knew what 5G was then in 2011, but I said, I want to do wireless work and use the streets of Manhattan, use the city as a real world environment. And NYU generally doesn't give anyone building access, but I said, look, you want to pull me from UT Austin, the top 10 place. I'm a chair professor. You know, I've got a dream job. I love the community in Austin. It's really a very friendly business community. I mean, you see all the Silicon Valley companies now building presence in Austin. I've been very blessed by the Lord to have a great career. If you want me to take a risk to a merger that might not happen, you've got to give me tenure in all three tax IDs the two at NYU, the med school and the main school, and also Brooklyn Poly, so that if it fails for some reason, the merger doesn't get done, I want to have a safe home for the rest of my academic life. They made it happen, and I've never worked so hard in my life. I got there in 2012, and as I tell people, it was a real fixer-upper. I think Brooklyn Poly was ranked 86th or 84th in the U.S. News and World Report. But by the grace of God and some really great people and some investments, we were able to convince the world that NYU was for real in electrical engineering and in wireless. And look at us today. I think NYU is ranked 35th. You know, that's an incredible climb in ranking. We're ranked the top wireless research program in the world by Fierce Wireless a few years ago. We recruited Tom Marzetta, who's now our director of NYU Wireless, who invented Massive MIMO. I have the most amazing colleagues, and the grad students we're starting to recruit to come to NYU are really some of the best in the world. And we now have 16 major companies from around the world who invest in us. And, you know, we're really motivated to add value to the wireless ecosystem, to help our students get the best jobs, to help our industrial affiliates have pre-competitive knowledge. So NYU is a lot of work, and it almost killed me, literally. But thankfully, you know, I feel like it was really worth the effort. I'm so proud of my colleagues and graduate students at what we've done. We've been very blessed, and I think it's the hard work and the lunch pail mentality that the faculty we have in the center have.
So you founded NYU Wireless. What led you to develop that group?
Well, part of their recruitment, when NYU and Brooklyn Polytechnic recruited me to help get the merger done, they wanted me to bring some kind of branding, some kind of collection of faculty, something that would bond the faculty together, because I've always been a big believer that wherever you work, whatever you're going to do, it's always more fun to involve other people and to be collaborative, because the total is always greater than the individual parts. I've always believed that. I saw that as a graduate student at Purdue. I saw that being one of 50 graduate students in the NSF Engineering Research Center, the first generation of ERCs. So that really imprinted upon my life the belief that it's always good to have a collaborative, cohesive vision. If everyone feels part of something bigger than themselves, you can always achieve more. And let me tell you, Pat, that's hard to do in academia, where the reward system is very individually based. It's very egocentric. What am I doing? What's my name on the vita? What's my name on the paper? I mean, academia can be a very selfish place. And if you look at corporate world, the corporate world is not so selfish. I mean, there's one stock price that everyone's working to ramp. So, you know, how do you inculcate this culture of working together and everyone achieving more by being part of a team? You know, if the students see that, they will be more ready to make an impact in industry. They'll be more team-oriented. They'll be more collaborative. So, you know, one of the things I told them is I wanted to create a research center that had a brand and it was multidisciplinary, you know, that could cross computer science into Caromp, that could cross into the med school, that could be part of engineering. And that was another reason why I wanted tenure in all three tax IDs. It wasn't just for job security. It was to be able to have the credibility and the ability to interact with, as a peer, with colleagues in all three of those departments, because you need computer science and medicine and engineering for the future of wireless. I really believe it. Wireless is going to be as fundamental as pencil and paper is. In fact, it's becoming that way in my lifetime. You know, I've always believed wireless would become so much a commodity and so much a part of the fabric of our lives. I was quoted in an article in Virginia Engineer in 1990, where I think I said something about, that. I predicted we'd have wristwatch cell phone in 1990. You know, all these things I was telling what wireless would do. You know, there'd be more data carried wirelessly than wired in 2020. I think I was saying that when I was a punk professor. And sure enough, it's happened. And so, I've always believed that you have to have this frothy, interdisciplinary community doing research, because research breakthroughs happen at the boundaries of different disciplines. So I told the administration, to answer your question, we needed to build a center and we needed sufficient space and investment to be able to have this kind of environment. And they said, go for it. They trusted me with the resources, and look what's happened.
Yeah, what was that term that you coined, data shower or something like that?
Oh, information shower.
Information shower.
That's my information favorite. Yeah, that's right. You have a good memory. I wrote that. I think I gave a keynote in 2008 or 2009 at Virginia Tech. They invited me back for their symposium that I started back there in the 90, 91 timeframe. And by the way, that's something that I feel so good about, that at all three wireless centers that I started, the Virginia Tech, UT, and NYU, we have an annual symposium that brings leadership from academia and industry from around the world together. You know, I just love it that it's still going, that they still do it. You know, it didn't need me or anyone else to keep going. It's still part of the fabric of those centers. Information shower is something I saw happening where wherever we walk or ride, our phones automatically updating, content's automatically being downloaded. That will happen. It already happens in so many applications. Our smartphone does that every day when we don't know it.
Yeah. So to me, your work with millimeter waves, which is the most important work that I've ever seen done in the wireless industry, you did all the channel modeling and proved that millimeter wave was viable for cellular communications. What convinced you that millimeter wave was the future of wireless at that point?
Well, that's very nice of you to say, Pat. I appreciate it. That's high praise coming from you. I know the work you do at Microwave Journal. You're really on top of a lot of things that are happening. I was very blessed to see this millimeter wave and higher. You know, I'm working on 6G and 7G now, terahertz and beyond. I shouldn't say terahertz and beyond, sub terahertz and beyond, up to terahertz. I saw back in the 1990s, in fact, in that 1990 Virginia Engineer article, I was talking about 60 gigahertz. Very few people in the world were thinking about millimeter wave in 1990, but I've always believed that fundamentally, if you can go higher in frequency, you get the commensurate narrow bandwidth to be much greater, right? It scales linearly. A percentage bandwidth scales linearly by the carrier frequency. So it was clear to me that if we were going to have massively broadband communication systems, you'd have to go higher and higher in frequency. That was just fundamentally clear to me and probably so many other people who thought of it. But most people just never thought frequencies up at that range would be viable. Well, they probably doubted it'd be viable because number one, the semiconductor industry wasn't moving there years ago. And number two, there was this myth that oxygen absorption and attenuation and so on would decay frequencies at higher frequencies. I want to dispel that myth to all your listeners right now. The channel does not fundamentally change going up to 800 or 900 gigahertz. So this idea that signals get weaker as you go up in frequency is total baloney.
That's only if you have- It's still a common belief. It's still a very common belief.
It's still a common belief. 99% of the wireless engineers still don't believe that the channel has no difference. It's because they're drinking the Kool-Aid of old textbooks. Old textbooks always show Harold Freeh's free space equation for an omnidirectional antenna. It's true for omnidirectional antennas, you have greater attenuation as you go higher in frequency. That is, the attenuation increases by F squared. But that's only if you have omnidirectional antennas at each end of the link. If you look at what an omnidirectional antenna does at higher frequency, it shrinks, right? An omnidirectional antenna becomes smaller and smaller at frequencies. If you use directional antennas on both sides of the link, you get gain that beats the loss. That is, you get better channels at higher frequencies. And I saw this back in the mid 90s. I knew this. I've known it for most of my life. But when I mentioned it a couple of times casually at cocktail parties, the reaction I got was so much in disbelief, I just kind of squelched it and just waited. I did some work at 38 gigahertz in the late 1990s where I confirmed my belief. I saw the power of directional antennas. You can find a paper I wrote at 38 gigahertz about Hale, I think in 98 or... But I knew this would happen. So I waited until around 2010 and 2011 in Austin when I saw Moore's Law starting to bring SIGI millimeter wave communications. Now, I think I'd done 60 gigahertz measurements in 2000, 2002. And I think the FCC opened up the bands around 2005, 2006. But I believed mobile would happen. I, in fact, wrote a paper, I think, in 2009 in IEEE JSAC, where I talked about 60 gigahertz mobile. And this is about the same time Samsung was interested. Samsung and I got together you know, when I was at UT Austin, and I had just done the measurements at 38 gigahertz showing mobile would work. And Samsung was very interested. They flew me to Korea. They set me up when I set up NYU Wireless. They were one of my founding industrial affiliate sponsors at the NYU Wireless program. So I always knew millimeter would happen at mobile, always knew it, but I just kind of had to wait for the market to be ready. I mean, if I would have tried to spend a lot of energy and time on it in the 1990s, I did. I wrote some papers in 1990s, early 2000s, but no one was really interested. So I kind of had to wait for the market to mature where, you know, your industry really only has, and by the way, this is a great value for NYU Wireless. This is what I try to do at all the academic programs. Industry only really has a 3 to 5 year time frame. They can't really invest beyond 3 to 5 years. So I had to wait for the 3 to 5 year time frame for millimeter wave to be viable. And coming to NYU, I knew 2012 that was about the right time. 4G was rolling out, LTE was rolling out, massive MIMO was really just on the radar. So I knew that that was about the right time. So when NYU gave me the offer, I thought, what a great world stage to prove to the world what I already knew. If I can make it in New York, I can make it anywhere, Pat. And I knew that if I could show that it works around buildings in New York City, the people would believe it, and I could probably get them to come to New York City. It's a lot easier to fly to than Blacksburg or Austin. So, you know, so that was a big boon, I think, for the industry and for my own career to be able to prove it in New York City. And it's a great proving ground. We have the world's best urban experimental facility, the campus of NYU with buildings in Brooklyn, buildings in Manhattan, to prove the future of wireless, and the administration is very supportive of it. So that's how I got into millimeter wave, and I kind of bided my time. There was plenty of other good things to do growing programs, but let me tell you why an academic center like NYU Wireless and WNCG and the NPRG I found at Virginia Tech, why these are so valuable. Industry only has a 3 to 5 year investment time horizon, basically. Basic R&D is very hard to do in companies. So for the cost of less than one fully loaded fresh out engineer, for an annual fee of much less than one loaded engineering cost, you get the mind share of 15 to 20 faculty, 100 graduate students, all doing vast research funded by millions of dollars of the federal government. So you can multiply the 100 grand a year investment by a factor of 300 or so for the pooled research. I mean, what kind of company that's serious about knowing where the hockey puck's gonna go is not gonna invest it? I'm just surprised we only have 16 companies, because it's, I think, the best value if you want to have an idea of where the industry is going to be beyond 5 years. You know, I try to do research 7 to 15 years out, you know, because by the time a PhD student gets out, they'll be an expert on where the industry is going to be 3 to 10 years out. And those are the kind of future leaders we want to produce in academia.
Yeah, it's perfect timing setup. So you did do a lot of those channel models, both in the urban and rural areas. What was the hardest about making those measurements? Because I know that took a lot of time and a lot of data gathering and a lot of analysis.
Yeah, you know, here's a story that most of the world doesn't know. I had a wonderful postdoc, he was a PhD student from UT Austin, Felix Gutierrez. Wonderful young man. He actually came to New York with me, NYU, and he worked with like 6 or 7 freshman students. These freshmen learned from Felix how to do measurements with the, and we kind of kept it, you know, together with bubble gum and baling wire, all this equipment that traveled from UT Austin with me. We made these measurements and trying to process the data and just getting students to learn the discipline, you know, from the RF world, the Microwave Journal covers it a lot, how hard it is to make good measurements. You have to calibrate, you basically have to be paranoid. You know, I teach all my students who are going to do experimental work, you have to be so paranoid. You have to check, double check, check in the morning, check in the evening. And, you know, teaching students to do that and how to detect problems and to make sure they're reproducible. They did it. Felix did a great job with these undergraduates, these freshmen. And the equipment broke like in mid-August. They started in June, early June. The equipment broke just in time to have gotten enough data to process the data for our famous paper, It Will Work. And Shu Sun, who went on to be one of my great PhD students at NYU, really led that paper. What's amazing is those students worked so hard and they learned the discipline and the tenacity of how to do experimental measurements and then how to process data and how to really make sure everything makes sense. You have to check and double check intuition, mathematical. So the transfer of knowledge from generation to generation of student is the hardest thing. Fortunately for me, Felix was the only one of my many students willing to take a risk and to come to NYU, and I will always be indebted to him. And those young freshmen did such a great job and co-authored that paper, the It Will Work paper in 2013. And it had an exclamation point on the end of it, Pat, because no one would have believed it. And I knew how hard of a sell it would be to the world. And even today, the world doesn't believe millimeter wave works. But you will see in 5 years from this interview, millimeter wave will be commonplace. Small cells will be commonplace. The myths will be busted about, you know, people will learn about antenna gain and the value of antenna gain overcoming the loss. And one of the great news is, one of the great stories that is yet to be told, I'm about to tell it in the next year in my research, is that all the densification for small cells and 5G is going to carry us for the next 20 years to 6G and 7G as we go up to terahertz frequencies, because the antenna gains will make up for any additional loss. Once we engineer these mobile systems for 70 or 80 gigahertz, all the rain attenuation, all the fog, all that stuff, it's flat out to a terahertz. So doing the small cell engineering for 5G is going to carry us out for the next 20 years. And the world doesn't know yet that yet, but they'll learn.
Yeah, and the higher in frequency you go, the smaller the antenna scale, so you can increase your array size and increase
exactly.
your energy.
More antenna elements, it becomes a packaging and RF power cooling efficiency problem. But that's right, for the same physical area, you're going to get more and more gain, which overcomes the loss. And you're going to do that in the handset as well. You know, we have 8 or 16 antennas now for millimeter wave. That's going to scale to 32, 64, 128, multiple RF chains as we go up to 100, 200, 300 gigahertz and above over the next 20 years.
So also you worked with the IEEE to establish wireless as a mainstream technology. Tell us about that.
When I was a young professor, there was a senior professor who had written a very famous book on signals and systems, Bill Tranter. Bill Tranter was the editor-in-chief of the IEEE JSAC, Journal on Selected Areas and Communications. And he saw something in me because I wrote this paper called The Wireless Revolution. I was like 1990 or 91. I wrote this obscure paper in the IEEE Communications magazine. And it was called The Wireless Revolution. I think in that paper, I end the paper by saying, you know, just like power utilities have wires connected to every house, someday wireless will be in every house. I wrote something crazy in the last paragraph. And he saw something in me. He called me, he said, you know, we're looking for some new blood, young blood in the Journal on Selected Areas and Communications. I think this was the early 90s. So I flew out to Rolla, Missouri, met him. We became friends. In fact, a few years later, I recruited him as a chaired professor, and he left Rolla and came with his family to Virginia Tech. Had dinner with the president, and we got him to come into the center with me. But he got me involved in JSAC. And from that, a college friend of mine, Khaled Ben Lataif, Khaled and I were just indoctrinated into the National Academy of Engineering. Khaled was a friend of mine from college at Purdue. He was, I think, the provost or dean at a great university in Hong Kong, Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, the MIT of Asia. And Khaled and I were both kind of young up-and-comers in the IEEE Communication Society. So together, he and I and Gordon Stuber, some other professors, started pushing the senior leadership to get more journals. We started the IEEE Journal on Wireless Communications, Wireless Communications Magazine. I wrote a number of compendia in 1995 and 96 for IEEE. They become huge sellers. The wireless communications textbook that I wrote, I actually did special edition that we sold through IEEE so that people could start teaching wireless. I mean, 95, there were no real textbooks that knew about the details of wireless. And I had done this company, TSR Technologies, that had built cellular and paging intercept equipment that was being used by the entire industry. So these books were really good. And I put together a compendia of papers that was sold by IEEE Press. So I brought all these products to IEEE Press and really launched the whole idea of wireless in IEEE, because just like my early proposals, you know, no one really saw wireless coming, but there was this avalanche of growth, and there had to be engineers. So I was fortunate to be involved in that. And
Sure, now it's a major part of their organization for sure.
Yeah, I think wireless is. Both IEEE Vehicular Technology and IEEE Communications Magazine. One of the neat stories that people may not know is that, you know, the whole idea of cellular and spread spectrum, you know, George Cooper once told us a story at Purdue how his student, Jordan Nettleton, George and he were trying to get a paper accepted in the IEEE Communications Journal, the transactions on communication, that there were so few wireless papers, it kept getting rejected and rejected. So they finally had to submit the paper to IEEE Vehicular Technology Transactions. So the VT became a place where a lot of the wireless papers went. And so I tried to convince the Communication Society, you're missing out on where the future of communications is going to be. So luckily the leadership listened, and now it is a big part of it.
Maybe before you go, you can just give us a quick glimpse of what you see in store for 6G and beyond.
I think massive MIMO is going to be huge, especially as we see the CBRS the cellular spectrum at 3.5 gigahertz offered as TDD. TDD works at millimeter wave. So TDD is going to allow easy massive MIMO, and much, much wider bandwidth channels are coming to 6G through millimeter wave and sub terahertz as these directional antennas and people understand site-specific deployment. And as they learn that people are very reflective at higher frequencies, millimeter wave and above, they will learn that millimeter wave is great with cell densification and even without cell densification. I believe 6G is going to be the first standard, 5G also, that you can start replacing fiber and copper with daisy-chained infrastructure. Wireless infrastructure could actually be put down alongside the highway on telephone poles without digging up any dirt, where you can carry things fiber-like to deliver broadband. I think that's a great opportunity for 5G infrastructure. 6G, the bandwidths and the capabilities will be great enough that you will, I think, someday start looking at wireless to the home. You won't have to dig up the yard, which we still do today. So I think that's going to happen. There's so many other things I could talk about. I mean, we're doing a lot of research at NYU Wireless on some of the key things, some of the key applications, both in medical and entertainment, huge opportunities. I think the technologies, the networking, the caching at the end, at the end of the network, I think Open RAN has legs. I think it'll happen in 6G, not so much in 5G, but you know, that's an area of trying to white box some of the infrastructure I think will start to happen in 5G. But there are just so many fascinating technologies that you can start doing when you start getting these higher frequencies and these directional antennas. There's a wide open array of problems that will and need to be solved. But while you turn, you know, my vision, my passion as an engineer has always been to turn the radio channel, the wireless radio channel, into something that's as known as stable as a piece of wire. And I think 6G will be the generation where wireless channels become so well understood and engineered based on the technology that allows us to exploit multipath and exploit the densification of 5G.
Thank you, Ted, for sharing your experiences and motivations through your career. You're truly an industry icon, and congratulations on your induction into the Wireless Hall of Fame. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of RF Industry Icons. Join us next month to find out who will be our next RF Industry Icon.